Perfect.
So everyone heard that announcement. Okay, so let's go back to sharing. All right, so I'm gonna motivate, then we'll go back to the lecture. Okay, so this is, can everyone see this clearly, this code?
Very, very clear.
Okay, so this was a solution to homework one in which we basically, when we wrote, read from global memory, we wrote to a location in shared memory, and that location was based upon a particular iteration that we have over here. Now the code looks a bit complicated. Now let's compare this to a simpler solution that we have here. In this case, we're reading from global memory, writing to shared memory, and here the address is simple. It's based upon the lane and this constant warp size. But in order to have this simplicity, what we also need to do is copy from one shared memory location to another. So we have two shared memory accesses, one to do the copy and one to load the new value. Down here, we're doing just a single access to shared memory to load data. So that is appealing because we're using fewer instructions. Now the question is it really worth it? In other words, is it as simple as it appears? Now, those who actually tried this know that it didn't run satisfyingly quickly. Plus there were, if you weren't careful, there were errors. So what we want to be able to do is analyze our code, figure out how fast it should be, look at how fast it is, and then say, well, if it's not as fast as it is, what's going on? You know, by looking at the assembly code. Okay, so that's why we're looking at instructions. All right, so I believe we were doing these lectures before. So let me make this larger. So here, these notes were looking at instructions, and I guess at predicate registers, the predicate instructions, we were stopped. So if you remember, a predicate register is a register that holds a one-bit value. It's called a predicate. They're written by special set predicate instructions, and examples are here. So set predicate is set P. That indicates that it's a set predicate instruction. I indicates that its arguments are to be interpreted as integers. And this is the predicate register that's being written. And this is a comparison. So what this instruction does is it sets P0 equal to the result of R1 equal R2. So if they're equal, the predicate's set to 1, otherwise it's set to 0. Okay, so that will set the predicate register. How are they used? And here we can see an example of the use of a predicate register. So here we have a floating point multiply instruction. And before that instruction, we see a predicate register. So what that indicates is if the value in this predicate register is true, we execute the instruction. If it's false, we ignore the instruction. We can also negate the predicate with an exclamation point. So that says if this predicate is equal to false, we execute the instruction. If it's true, we ignore the instruction. So it's kind of like an if statement. Okay. Now, in terms of the efficiency of code execution, it's not, if the predicate is false, most cases, the hardware is still going to fetch and execute the instruction, but simply the result will be discarded. So the typical benefit of predicated instructions in CPUs, does anyone remember what the benefit is for CPUs of predicated instructions? Anyone? If not, so the benefit for CPUs is the following. Sometimes a predicate is not known until very late. So when it's time to start to fetch this instruction, the value of the predicate is unknown. It's not known until this instruction is partly executed. So if we used an ordinary branch instruction, the branch would be delayed. But by using a predicated instruction, we could start fetching this instruction right away. And if it turns out the predicate is false, we ignore the value. Okay, so that works if you only predicate one or two instructions. Okay, for GPUs, we have a second reason, and that is within a warp, we might have 32 threads. And for some of those threads, a predicate is true, for some it's false. Okay, so this efficiently lets us take a code path that all the threads take together. All right, so this is a simple version of the predicated instruction. Usually what you want to do is combine them. So in code, you might have a complicated if statement. So you might say if R1 is equal to R2 or R3 is equal to R4 and so on. To convert that into code, we need to basically take the first comparison, say R1 is equal to R2 might set one predicate register. Then when you do another comparison, say and R3 is equal to R4, you basically say if that first predicate is, you want to and that second comparison with the first predicate, okay? And that is the idea with combining these things. So here in this full example, we're doing a greater than comparison and we're anding the new comparison, which is R1 is greater than R2, with the previous value, with the value in P1 to give us a value in P0. So it's actually P3 holds the old value that we're anding with. This is a new comparison that's written to P0. Here, what we do is these instructions actually write two predicates. Basically, one is the inverse of the other. Okay, so when we're looking at the GPU assembly code, we're going to see a lot of these predications. All right, what else? Constant address space. So this is something that's important to understand well, because if it's used efficiently, code goes fast. If not, it goes very slow. So we know about the constant address space, how to do it in CUDA code. In the CUDA assembly language, accesses to constant address space are shown with a C followed by two square bracketed quantities. The first one is a shared memory bank. The second one is a shared memory address. So here is an example. So this is a multiply add instruction, an integer multiply add. And what it's computing is R11 times whatever is in shared memory at this address plus R19. So constant memory. So this is a constant memory reference, bank 0, address 8. Okay, now, so in this case, we're using constant memory as a direct argument to an instruction. This only works if the address is a constant. If the address is not a constant, then ordinary load instructions are used. So here's a code example. This code example shows constant addresses. Okay, so first of all, this is CUDA C, and here we've declared a constant, something in the constant address space. Okay, this code refers to the block dimension. Now, the block dimension is automatic. It's not something that we declare, but CUDA will automatically put that in the constant address space. Furthermore, there are two arguments here, array in and array out. Those are also automatically put in the constant address space. Okay. So here is the equivalent CUDA assembly code. And some of it is commented. And I didn't see what R1 does. Yeah, R1 is not used. But so let's go here. So what we're doing is we're computing the thread ID. And to do that, we take the block dimension times block index. So the block dimension is in this part of constant memory. Now, this is something the compiler knew. It's not something that we are expected to know, but we are expected to understand it. So bank zero is used for these built-in variables. So bank zero, address 8 is a block dimension. R0 is the value of block index. And if you look at this code, you could see it was set. So remember, we covered special registers, and this special register is a block index. So we're moving the special register into a conventional register. So S2R is special to register. Okay. So here's a constant reference for the block dimension. Remember that we have an argument called array in that's also put in constant memory, and that's being read over here where we do a multiply add. So in this case, this is taking, so here we have array in of TID. So what we need to do is we need to read from memory array in. So what this line is doing is it's computing a memory address. This part here is the address of this array. R2 and R6, well, one of these, R2 is equal to the thread ID. And can anyone tell me what R6 is? Now, if we look at the code, we could see what value it's assigned. It's assigned up here. Can someone tell me what that 4 is? Anyone?
It's not addressing. I cannot see the 4.
Okay, I'm having problems hearing. I think it's Ellen.
Yes.
But one more time.
I cannot see the for loop. What I see is just the PDF file.
Okay, I'm still having problems hearing.
Is that the address or block ID?
No, it's not that. So this is, we're computing the memory address of this location. TID is register R2. So R2 is TID. That was computed over here.
Is it the multiplier of each TID?
Right, but where does that 4 come from? How do we do, why is it 4? Or how could you change it to 2 or 8?
Like each thread taking 4 places, that's my guess.
No, it's not that. Look at this array in. It's declared float. That means each element of the array is a floating point value. What's the size of a float?
4 bytes.
Right.
4.
So if I change it to a double, then this 4 would change to an 8. So what we're doing is we're multiplying by the size of the element. So that's being computed here. So our 4 is going to be the address that we load from. Or to be absolutely precise, it's actually the lower 32 bits. The upper 32 bits are computed here. And so now we do the load from memory. Okay, what about some constant? Some constant is also in constant memory, and that's accessed over here. So we take some constant, that's this, and we multiply it by the value loaded from memory. So here, notice that the bank is bank two. So bank zero is used for the program arguments and things like blockdin. Bank two is used for things that are statically declared like this. Okay? Now, in all of these cases, the address that we're loading from constant memory is constant. So when we do that, we can basically have the constant load as an argument to our instructions, and that makes things efficient. What if we're loading from some variable location in constant memory? Then this won't work. Let's see if I have an example here. No. All right, so let's take a look at an example from what we've done in class. And okay, so here, where are we reading from constant memory? I think this one. So if we look over here in this code example, we are loading from constant memory. Now the question, so we're loading from constant memory here. Is this a constant address? Do we know it? Is this a constant address?
Yes.
What about J? Is J a constant?
No.
Okay.
It changes.
Okay. It changes, but it changes. And so the answer depends upon how it is compiled. If this loop is unrolled, the J loop, then it's a constant because there'll be, I don't know, 32 copies of this, each with a different value of J. But if the loop's not unrolled, it won't be constant. So let's take a quick look at this. All right, so here, if we look at the code, so this line here is a multiply add, and we could see we have an access to constant memory right there. It's using bank three, and notice these addresses, how they change. That's because this loop has been unrolled. Okay?
Okay.
So how do we not unroll it? And the answer is?
Force it?
Well, there are different ways. One thing we can do this. Unroll one, and I spelled pragma wrong. So unroll one means don't unroll. So let's see if this is gonna work. All right, so here we are back to the same routine. And here we are. So, by the way, one of the changes that I made recently is I put the source code in the SAS here. So here, this is a multiply add. Where is the load from constant memory? And that is over here. So now we're loading from constant memory. We could see this, but now instead of having a constant, we have the value of register R3. So we would like for this, this is what we want to do, if we could. This would be nice, okay? This is what we want, but the instruction set does not support an arithmetic instruction in which the constant memory reference has a variable, a register in it. So this won't work. So for that reason, we have a separate load instruction followed by a multiply add. Okay, everyone see that? By the way, there's something else, some other difference between the two code samples that you might have noticed. So if you remember from that previous code sample, we basically had a load from shared memory followed by a multiply add. Basically 32 pairs like that. Now for each iteration of this loop, how many instructions do we have? 3, 6, 9, like 10 instructions. So we've gone from 2 instructions to 10 instructions. Okay. So why is it that we need so many more instructions? Here we're just adding one more instruction because we need to do this load, but we also needed to compute R3, which added an instruction plus additional instructions for this loop to increment the variable and determine when we exit the loop. So if we don't unroll the loop, this is what we get. Okay, so let's get rid of this. There's one more thing I want to mention about constant memory accesses, and it has to do with the hardware capabilities. So when we load from constant memory, there is basically one port on the constant memory. It's unlike shared memory where there are 32 banks, which means, and we could do 16 reads simultaneously. In contrast, for constant memory, there's just one. And that means is that if all of the threads are reading the same location in constant memory, that's not a problem. But if each thread is reading a different address in constant memory, then it will take 32 times, or right, strictly speaking, 16 times longer than if they all read the same address. So a factor of 16 slowdown if we are reading different values from constant memory. And that's an important thing to remember, since it's a big difference. All right, so so this shows different uses of constant memory, how it's compiled here. All right, so immediates. An immediate is a constant in the instruction. So look at this add instruction. It's computing R3 plus this value here. So this is an immediate. This is also an immediate. Take a look at this load instruction. Here, it's loading from address R2 plus the constant 4. That's also an immediate. Now, the immediate is placed in the instruction and that limits the size. So an important question to know is how large the immediates are. So in the older GPUs, the Maxwell and Kepler, the Kepler GPUs, the immediate could be as large as 31 bits, which is a very large value, which means these offsets, so that means if you do things like unroll loops, you can have really big offsets. For the later generations, I think it's smaller, like 20 bits, which is more like a CPU offset. Okay. So when you look at this code, these are the constants, they're called immediates, and the sizes vary, 21 bits for offsets and probably for the others. Right, so I have them here. So for Kepler, it was 31 bits. Unfortunately, they got rid of that. So now it's about 22 bits. And is there anything here? Yeah, memory access instructions. So shared memory, load and store shared. Offsets are optional. Constant memory, we've seen that. Load constant. So it looks like the same format you would use when you put it in an arithmetic instruction, except here you can have a register. Local memory, LDL and STL. And by the way, the colors here are just syntax highlighting. Obviously the assembly language itself doesn't have these colors. And these are highlighted just to emphasize the fact that you don't actually want to access local memory. In other words, often it's done by accident. And if you do it on purpose, generally the idea is to minimize its use. All right. So this is shared, constant, and local. This is a generic load instruction. A generic load instruction means that the compiler didn't know what address space the value is in. So the hardware is going to look at this address and figure out whether it's global, shared, or local. Okay. So that is useful if you have pointers in your code. And when you assign a pointer variable, it might be a pointer to shared memory or local or global. So now the compiler will let you do it and the hardware will figure it out. And there seems to be almost no performance penalty for doing this. Well, I should say, if you are definitely accessing shared, there's a penalty, but if you're not, it's fine. Okay, here's a global reference where it's definitely global. And we haven't talked about this much, and probably won't in class, but here we're accessing the texture space. All right, I just have a few more examples of instructions, and I don't have a comprehensive set of notes, just some scattered ones, but I'll be giving you some homework so that you can exercise this, look stuff up. All right, so I'm gonna post these, and these are just a few other examples, and I'm here. This is stuff that I've already covered, generic, global, and local. So vector loads and stores, we did talk about them when we were looking at high-level code. We said that for those vertex transform examples, we said that we could actually load four values at once, a four-element vector, and here, is the equivalent SAS instruction. So this looks like a generic load, except it's followed by a number, and that's a number of bits. So this loads 128 bits. Since a register is 32 bits, those 128 bits are going to span four registers. So this loads a value from memory, and it's loading 16 consecutive bytes, putting them into four registers. R36 is the first of those four. It also will load 37, 38, and 39. So when we're doing these vector loads, we have to load consecutive registers, and I believe the sizes are 1, 2, or 4. Well, 1 isn't a vector, so 2 or 4. As I pointed out in class earlier, you can't do 8 registers, which would be nice since that would fill a request. Okay. A subword store. A subword store is a store which is storing less than 32 bits. So here, this is store shared, and what makes it a subword store is this part, 16. So this means that we're storing 16 bits. Okay, so what this thing will do is it'll take the least significant 16 bits of R25 and store it in memory at that address. Okay, so subword store is something which is commonly done in CPUs, although typically it might be called like a store byte or a store half. So here it's distinguished by putting the number of bits over here. This stuff I talked about in PDF notes. Prefetch instructions, I'll probably get back to that if we come back to it. Some notes on floating point. Let's see. So floating point and other arithmetic instructions can have floating point immediates, which is a little different than CPUs. Negated register arguments, absolute value, and constant space arguments. So I have examples further below on this. So this. So there are kind of two categories of instructions, ordinary and special. So earlier we talked about something called an FP32 and then a special functional unit. So the ordinary instructions will use like an FP32 or an FP64. Special instructions use a special functional unit. So the ordinary instructions are add, subtract, multiply, multiply, add, and conversion. The ones that use a special are reciprocal, square root, cosine, and sine. And I'll show you the references for that. Okay, single and double precision. Single precision floating point are prefixed with an F, for example, floating point multiply. Double precision is prefixed by a D. Okay, so some examples here. First of all, here is an example of a floating point instruction with an immediate. The immediate value is equal to 1. Here is another one where the immediate value is 0.5. Those that are used to CPU instruction sets will find this unusual. So CPU instruction assembly languages and instruction sets typically do not have floating point immediate values, whereas GPUs usually do. Another unique GPU feature is this. I don't know if you've noticed it, but that's minus R19, meaning it's going to use a negated value of register 19. So that's in the NVIDIA GPU instruction set, typically not in CPU instruction sets. And here, absolute value. So it's another thing. Not only can you negate something, you can take the absolute value. So if it's for CPU, you need a separate absolute value instruction. Here you don't. Okay, and here we can see the constant address space. Any questions so far? Okay. Does anyone happen to know what that is? Does anyone know from experience? FTZ? So that refers to floating point rounding. So FTZ means flush to zero, meaning very small values are made equal to zero. So all right, so here's some example of some special instructions. So first of all, special instructions are prefixed with MUFU, which stands for like multiple, multi-purpose functional unit, something like that. So this simply means that it's a kind of special instruction category, and these are mostly the special unit. And this is the mnemonic for the instruction itself. So one important instruction is reciprocal. So that's going to compute, in this case, 1 over R4. There's also reciprocal square root, which computes, you know, the reciprocal square root. So one thing that there is not, at least in many versions of the instruction set, is there's no divide instruction. If you need to do division, you basically need to compute the reciprocal of the divider and then multiply it, you know, by the dividend. And that's how you do it. So it's two instructions to do division. Okay, reciprocal square root is a built-in instruction, and that's there because in many cases we need to do vector normalization. So a reciprocal square root would be used for that. So that reflects the use in graphics. There's also a cosine and sine instruction. One thing to watch out for is that these instructions are approximate. So if you use, say, the cosine and sine in the C library, which is probably the way you'd use it, you're going to get a library function, not just the cosine instruction. There is a way of specifying, a special way of specifying that you truly want to use a cosine. And you would do that if you didn't mind, if you didn't need the full precision. So if an approximation were fine, then you would use those. Few other instructions. All right, move instruction, this should be self-explanatory. Okay. If we look at, I should write what this is. So one interesting thing, or annoying, depending upon who you ask, about the NVIDIA GPUs is that the register size is 32 bits. The memory address is 64. That's annoying because in order to compute a memory address, you need to use several instructions. Okay, so first of all, this applies to generations before 7.0. So finally, the Volta Turing generation can do 64-bit integer arithmetic. So in order to do 64-bit integer arithmetic in the earlier generations, you need to do a pair of instructions. So look at this add. What we're doing here is we want to add a constant, and the constant here is in a constant space, to register zero. So what we want to add it to something which is in two registers, R0 and R15. Let me write this out. Okay, let's make C the constant. So here the assignment is C is in so it's in those two locations. A is in so what register do I put here? Anyone? R15. Okay, so which registers are used? Which registers used for S? Remember, we're computing this. Just look at those two lines here.
Three
and 32. So least significant. I have to say lower 32. Is going to be in R32. And of course the upper 32 is in R33. So look what's going on. So we start here by doing this add. Now when we add R0 to that value, it's possible it's going to be an overflow. So this is a 32-bit sum and it might overflow. This CC says basically put the overflow value in the condition code registers. Now this add, the X, says use the overflow as a third bit to add on. So this is going to be, in fact, I'm gonna show you. What we're doing here is we're adding R15, plus C, plus the carry out. And that, of course, was computed here. So the carry out is from this. So basically, these two instructions compute a 64-bit sum. Now, this is important for computing memory addresses, and it's one reason why coding GPUs, especially for the older generations, one had to do lots of loop unrolling because that reduces the amount of arithmetic used for computing addresses. The Turing and Volta generation actually can do 64 bits. So you'll see instruction pairs like this a lot, a CC followed by an X, and what that's doing is it's computing a 64-bit quantity. All right, conversion. This converts, well, a 32-bit to a 16-bit, which basically means it's truncating it. So these are conversion instructions. I to I means it's going from one integer format to another. These are shift instructions, shift left and shift right. Okay, these should be obvious. As with the special functional unit, logical operations have a special prefix, and that's LOP, and LOP is an abbreviation for logical operation. So this is going to be an AND instruction. This is a bitwise AND, bitwise exclusive OR. So this is simply doing an AND of R0 with one, a bitwise AND, which means it's simply extracting the least significant bit. And this one is flipping the least significant bit. So these should be easy to understand for those that have assembly-language experience. This instruction is also an unusual one. I'm going to get rid of these memory addresses. Okay, selection instructions. First of all, let's look at this line of C code. So if P0 is true, we want R5 to equal R4, otherwise set R5 to this constant. Okay. So here is one way of doing that. In fact, it's only this line. So we have a select instruction. So here, R5 is being assigned. Now, if the predicate is true, R5 will be assigned to this. If the predicate is false, R5 is assigned to that. Everyone see that? Okay, now this one, someone tell me what that one does. Why are there two predicates here?
So means these two conditions must be satisfied together?
It's not that they're satisfied together. It's if P1 is false, don't make any change at all. So here, if P1 is false, no, if P1 is true, R18 is not changed at all. If P1 is false, then it's either set to R10 or R21, depending upon P0. So it would be like this. I'm going to use the conditional operator here. So it would be equivalent to this, meaning if P1 is false, then we do this. Otherwise, we make no change at all. Okay. Welcome back. Okay, now control flow, I'm going to cover this later. I'll cover some of the control flow, but this is something which is important to understand in detail. It's interesting. So BRA is a branch instruction. This is the address to which the branch is going. And P is a predicate guarding it. So the branch is taken, in this case, if P1 is true. This one is taken if P0 is true. Now, the U here basically adds another condition. And what that says is the branch is taken under two conditions. Number one, P0 is true, and that it's true for every thread in the warp. If it's false for any thread in the warp, then the branch is not taken for all of them. So it's kind of like we only go if we all go together. If one stays behind, we all stay behind. So that's a uniform branch. Okay, so we'll see where that can actually be used to useful effect. Okay, exit here basically exits the kernel. And I think we all know what this is. It's a barrier. And this is a function call. So this is a function call, and that's just a symbol which names the routine. All right, so that's a sampling of some of the instructions that are available. Okay, now what, all right. So let's go back and we talked about being able to estimate execution time. And let me show you something. This is going to be homework two, or it's the current version of homework two. And let me explain what you're looking at. There are two kernels here, and this is similar to homework one. But notice what we're doing here, and that is we're taking this variable dj and we're modifying it. And we're looking at how efficiently things run. Everyone see that? So in homework one, DJ was a constant. The only way to compare performance with different values of DJ was to recompile it. Here, on the other hand, it's something that could be placed in a loop, and that's what we're looking at. DJ going from 4 up to 512. Everyone see that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Now, notice something about these bars. Well, first of all, here we have the floating point throughput, and this is for the multiply add instructions. Here we have the data throughput, okay, in gigabytes per second. Now notice that as DJ increases, floating point throughput goes up, data throughput goes down. If you remember, the number of floating point operations per element is equal to DJ. So the larger DJ is, the more work that we have. Okay. The more work we have. Now the question though is, why then does this go up? Why is this constant?
Excuse me?
Yes.
So the more DJ is the more warp or work?
W-O-R-K. So let's take a look at the code.
Okay.
Just to remind you. All right, so this is a version of the simple kernel that we were working with. Yeah, I bet you can hear what's going on in the background. Anyway, all right, so here, this is the kernel wbuf, and dj is the iterator for the end condition for this loop, right? And this was a constant before, but now it is something that can be changed. We can launch the kernel with different values of dj. So the larger dj is, the more multiply add operations we do per element. Okay. So an interesting question and a fundamental question is the amount, what's sometimes called the computational intensity, how many floating point operations we do for each item loaded or stored from memory. And that determines whether something is compute bound or data bound. So I'm going to try to finish this up since we're running out of time. So you notice here when we do these bars, basically it's an estimate here. If we see the stars, that means performance is determined by data. If we see these plus signs, it means it's determined by floating point operations. And you can see as we increase DJ, we switch from being data bound to compute bound. So what data bound means is if we get, say, a GPU that could transfer data off chip more quickly, performance would improve. Here, if we get a chip that could transfer data more quickly, it wouldn't affect performance because we're compute bound. But if we could do more floating point operations, things would be better. Okay, so that's what's basically shown here. And the idea behind homework two is that we want to be able to find a break-even point where we switch from going from data bound to compute bound. Also, ideally, when we compute these things, we want this to be flat, or at least we want to be able to accurately estimate. So these bars are computed by finding a bound, which in effect is going to be an estimate of how fast code would run if it were perfectly written. All right, any questions on this? Okay. All right, so watch the web page. Office hours would be the usual time, and we could do Zoom or just email or whatever. As far as the lecture itself goes, let me know if there are any problems. First of all, is bandwidth an issue for anyone? Everyone has good internet, no problems?
I'm fine.
Okay. All right, so watch the web page, and I hope to assign something tonight or tomorrow, and I will see you guys on Wednesday. Okay? So, bye.
Thank you.